All right. I'm ready to go when you are. We have said that the perfect precision of the way cause and consequence works is often ironic. And so these talks should be an imitation of that. And so we will have irony for a few minutes. And the irony will be that we're going to be very strong and preachy about the subject of being strong and preachy. We're talking in this series about cause and consequence. And the talks are not really well organized because I'm exploring new territory. And when that happens, I don't have the full gestalt of it, and I put it together more or less in serial form. Now, the principle of cause and consequence is not new. In fact, it is very old. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand it with new consciousness. That's the way things are. We don't try to go back to the way things have been understood before. We have experienced that already. We take that and we move it forward, and so we look at old things in new ways. In the process of this, we're trying to clear up misconceptions, and we're trying to be practical about cause and consequence in ways that can relieve unnecessary suffering and enhance our soul growth for ourselves and for those around us. We're focusing a lot on attitudes about and within cause and consequence, because attitude is one of the major problems about cause and consequence. We're also trying to correct historical misconceptions, and maybe some of our own misconceptions that we've held along the way. But when we're doing all of these things, we're not trying to do it with an attitude of trying to teach a lesson. We do sometimes tend to judge others, and we're pretty self-righteous when we do that. And that is especially the case with cause and consequence, because cause and consequence is right within us, and we are right within it. We sometimes tend to quite judgmental about other people's destiny, not so much our own, but other people's. And in that, we can apply that to the principle itself. God is not trying to teach us a lesson through cause and consequence. That is a mistaken kind of thinking. It is a personalization. And it crept up in a time when people took things very personally. There was vengeance and all of that kind of thing. But the universal spirit and any agency within it that works through cause and consequence is not trying to teach a lesson. Personalization is one of the consequences of our very materialistic egoism. It is a consequence of our having fallen deeply into matter, which is subject that's going to come up quite a few times tonight. Stated as simply as possible, God is. Period. Things are as they are in God because that is their nature, whether we understand them or not. Sometimes we judge things by ourselves rather than the nature of things. Consciousness of the universal spirit is universal. It is macrocosmic. It is general. It is unconditioned and it is unconditional. It is itself within itself. It's not particular. There is particularization in it. This is particularization within the universal spirit. But it, in itself, is not particular. I told you, this is going to be strong to preach. Yeah, but at least I'm not pounding my fist in my hand or something like that. because of our current overweening focus in matter, we tend to set particulars in the center of our consciousness rather than universals. And in our insecure egoism, in our, you might say, our detention or our isolation or our quarantine in matter, we see things very personally. Now, there are things that we can learn through destiny, and there are lessons. But it really isn't a matter of trying to teach somebody a lesson in a very personal way. We are part of the co-creators in the universal spirit. And cause and consequence is part of our creative feedback. We're going to go into that a lot tomorrow and Thursday as we talk about this. Now, the manifestations of the universal spirit, besides being ironic, are also very poetic. And there is an ethic, and there is a morality about them. But the ethic and the morality are in the living of the spirit. And they're not something like a standard that is etched like the Ten Commandments or something like that in stone. It's something that particulars can be derived from it, but the true nature of spirit is spiritual. And it's not intending to preach to us. We probably learn best anyway when we're candid and when we're relaxed and we're living out our lives rather than thinking about what the next lesson is or the next punishment or something like that. Goodness and morality are implicit within the nature of spirit. Now, let's talk about reality. And in reality, there are degrees of authentic existence. And those degrees of authentic existence relate to the various different spiritual worlds. And they are progressively inward. They're progressively creative. They are progressively antecedently causal. Even going to the next highest realm, going to the desire world, one comes back with a feeling that things there are more real. Because in that state of being, we are closer to the spiritual source of everything. And that is a greater reality. That's a perfect example of progressive levels of authentic existence. You could even say that there is a hierarchy of truth and a hierarchy of value. More and more, as we go on in life, we recognize that some things are more important than other things. And we learn that in our meditations, when we reach so-called higher states of consciousness, we recognize that they represent something that's much more important than the minutia and the trivia of our lives. Now we're capable of experiencing these states of being. In fact, it is our duty and our destiny to experience these states of things because we're part of the creation. We are creators and we are necessary to the fulfillment of the whole creative process, just like each piece of a crossword puzzle, of a jigsaw puzzle, is necessary to completing the whole picture. These different states of more authentic existence are not something external. They're not something arbitrary. They're not something artificial. There is hierarchical objectivity and hierarchy values to that, but it's not a matter of it being a no man's land of personal existence. personal values, where people think my good is as good as your good. We're talking about living real goodness. When we speak about objective values and real knowledge of them, you can't just speak about them in words. Even a talk like this, which is intended to be serious, can be a mockery. Because these kinds of things can only be lived. And to the degree that we live them, and we realize them, there's no other way about it. So, we are indeed scaling a mountain of truth, beauty, and goodness. And each step that we take up that mountain, we have a grander vista. And we get to see more of the panorama of total being. But the only way we can make those steps is to live our way into them. One does not passively see spiritual world. One brings one's level of living. One uses those words. One brings one's vibration to the level where one can experience them. It is a matter of sympathetic vibration that one attunes oneself to a higher state of living. It's the only way it comes about. So, that's what we have to say in a teaching way. About judgmentalism is cause and consequence, which is something that happens really easily. So after all of that, we deserve something more lively. So let's talk about a story. We talk about a profane story that is taken from a grand myth. The grand myth, high myth, is the myth of Amlodhi and his magical mill, which is the mill of Hamlet, where the theme for Hamlet plays on. It's in the story of Hamlet. Amlodhi was a titan, and he had a creative millstone, and the millstone was of cosmic proportions. The millstone was indeed Zodiac. And the millstone generated all sorts of good things. But every now and then the millstone would go crazy and it would get out of joint, the spindle would get out of its joint, and things would all change. He's talking about the precession of the equinox, so that the seasons happen with different constellations behind him because the millstone has shifted. There's a wonderful book called Hamlet's Mill by an MIT and Harvard philosopher of science that goes into this myth and they do a reasonable job of it. But we're going to talk in this case about a folk tale that is taken from that grand myth. Folk tales often draw on high mythology in order to bring practical, worldly, wise people to lessons to people who cannot contemplate the higher things. They all have little morals in them. And the story that we're going to look at is called Why the Sea is Salt. It has a hero, of course. The hero is somebody who did very good deeds in the goodness of his heart. And for his doing these goods, or these good things, he was given a mill. And he was given a starting command and a stopping command. So that if he said, mill, make honey, and give it the starting command, the mill would grind out honey until you give it the stopping command. You could do that with honey or gold or whatever you wanted. And he returns to his home, treadmill and he lives a comfortable and not an ostentatious life or anything like that. And he's just a good sort and he fits in with everyone. He's temperate as much as he is innocent and giving to people. The word gets around. Word gets around about spiritual things. There are rumors and people hear, you know, I've had it happen sitting in a restaurant and people talking about spiritual things and get up and go to the toilet and you listen to people at the next table in the booth and you're talking about ghosts and things like that. They're picking it up, but they're picking it up on the level that they know it and not on the level that, you know, that it is being emanated out on. But at any rate, some pirates get wind of this, and they want to go to sea, and they want to have salt. So what they do is they come to him, and they say, would you show us your magic mill that grinds out, and would you grind out salt? And so he gives it the command to start, and it starts pouring out salt, and they pounce on him. And they grab the mill, and they put it on the ship, and they go to sea. And what happens is what often happens to us. We start things that we can't stop. And they get going, and they run away from us. And they try every word that they can think of to stop the mill from producing salt, and they're unsuccessful. Most people don't think about vibrating to keywords or things that open spiritual worlds to us by us accommodating ourselves to them. So pretty soon, they're dumping salt over the side of the boat, but their efforts are futile. What happens is so much salt is built up that it sinks the ship, and the mill is still at the bottom of the ocean, grinding out salt, and this is why the sea is salt. You can see that this is the same myth in very different clothing. Salt always represents zest. Salt in the body is what materializes things. The chemistry of the fetus is salt because that facilitates rapid growth. And the chemistry stays until about 6 weeks after birth. It stays salt, saline. The only other time that the body chemistry goes toward the sodium direction is when you have cancer, and it is facilitating a very fast material growth in terms of a cancerous tumor. So when it is said, you are the salt of the earth, that means both that we are the zest of the earth and that we give the flavor to the earth, but it also means that we have been grinding out salt as the representative of sin, of generation driven into materialization. And so that's what is meant by this. The mill, like Amlodi's mill, is the mill of destiny, the wheel of rebirth, the wheel that goes around and things come around. It's that kind of a consciousness. Now the law, the principle cause and consequence, which is within that, is like the universal spirit because it is within the universal spirit. You might even say it's something like a precipitate of the universal spirit. And this has been known by mystery students for ages. For example, in the Orphic mystery schools of Plato and Pythagoras and the Neoplatonists and the Neopythagoreans, the highest attribute of the spirit was the good. You know the truth, beauty, and goodness? Truth was the, just as it is in Christianity, the spirit of truth is the Holy Spirit, the human spirit. Beauty is associated with the shine of light and love that comes from the life spirit, but the ultimate goodness of all things is associated with the divine spirit. So the law is not a hard taskmaster, unless we make it that way. If we get hard-nosed, we can't expect anything but hard-nosed stuff to come back to us. The law is made to facilitate the good and to create better forms of goodness, to create new forms of goodness, which is unbounded. There is no end to the goodness that there can be. It's like some of the characters in fairy tales. They're so good that there's no end to their goodness. So, it is exactly like the mill of our hero. It was capable of producing anything and everything that was harmonious. But it was also capable of producing things that were unharmonious. What we're trying to get at here is that we are free beings to the extent that we are in control of ourselves, that we can start and stop our actions, that we can stop eating instead of pigging out or something like that. So to the degree that we are in control of ourselves and identify ourselves with the purpose of creating goodness, we become divine creative beings. So when we think about the principle of cause and consequence, it behooves us to think of it in terms of positivity and to believe in the benignity of people. If we want to progress and we see the goodness in people, they begin to know it in themselves. And when we do that, we become like the Creator that is behind all of this. And cause and consequence is just the means of finalizing that, of bringing it to completion. And it's going to happen as surely as consequence follows cause. Source of the law is good. The law itself is good. St. Paul tells us that the end of the law is love. By that he means that the region of human spirit, where principles are divided into cause and consequence, is a precipitate of the realm of life spirit, the realm of pure love, truth, wisdom, the home of Christ. And so that's exactly what he's saying. If we look in the Gospels, Christ Jesus says, I come to fulfill the law. That is, to bring the law back into focus of the love. Not necessarily all of our personal ends in all of this. So if the law is producing anything that doesn't seem good, we have to look to ourselves, and because we are the cause. We are the ones who mis-expressed our creative freedom before we knew what to do, and we introduced ad harmony into the cosmos. We selfishly tried to take immortality for ourselves by taking control of the procreative force, which is one expression of the divine creative force. And because we did that out of harmony with intent, and we did it selfishly, we introduced ad harmony into the whole cosmos. So we are the ones that have to suffer the salt. But the law is much more benign than you realize. Like we've been talking about the position of grace in the law in future talks, they're in all the is this one. We, like the law itself, are expressions of the one. We are within the one universal spirit, and the one universal spirit is right within the law. Oneness cannot destroy its own self. It just must be itself. So if we look from the Rosicrucian philosophy, we see that which we call evil merely as a temporary condition of ad harmony within something that is a grand harmony that really resounds. And what we call evil is really good in the making, because the system is so perfect that ultimately everything has to end up for the good. It can't be anything other, because that's what the reality is. It is all good. It's worth taking all the pains and efforts to overcome our very human, our very sinful nature, to become something beyond what we are now, to return to spiritual realms from which we came in the first place. So, while we're on this subject of an unassailable and an untarnishable goodness in the law, it seems wise to expand on this, and we'll do that by mentioning that one of the purposes of the law with regard to human evolution is individuation. We said that yesterday, and it's worth repeating a few times again. The law is of the third principle, the Jehovistic principle that takes and formally unself-conscious unity of humanity and breaks it into nations and tribes and families, until finally it brings us down to being individuals. And thus, when we are thoroughly conscious of every cause that we initiate, and we bring it to completion so that the consequence of it comes back to us, it rebounds into our consciousness, because the consequence is really just a silhouette of what the cause was in the first place. We become aware of ourselves as individual creative beings. So the law helps us to become very keenly and astutely aware of ourselves as individuals. Through cause and consequence, we objectively know ourselves in ways that we can test, in ways that we can try, in ways that are logical. In some ways, you might say that the pull of the cause and consequence is literally the trunk of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because we gain very definite knowledge. Not necessarily wisdom, but very definite knowledge. In the mirror of consequences, we can't help but to know ourselves, very clearly. That whatever happens to us is a perfect reflection of what we have done and what we haven't done. Through cause and consequence, through the experience of the soul growth of initiating causes and carrying them out, is the way we unfold our being. It's the way we share what we have of divine creative potential. By their fruits you shall know them. And if we don't have a flowering and a fruiting from our creative potential, you know, we're not fulfilling things, and other people cannot be helped. So what we're talking about here is a creation within the creation that is brought about by the principle of cause and consequence. It is a mechanism, which is a word I really don't like using in this context, for accomplishing things. So we're talking about self. We're talking about creative self. So we have to deal now what is one of the most difficult problems of all spiritual philosophy. And that is the problem of self. What does one do with the self? Or what does one do about the self? Now, when we use the word self, we're using it with a capital S. We're not speaking of the lower ego, that pseudo-self, that personal self. We're speaking of self as a divine individuality. We're speaking of a spiritual ego and not a personal ego. Now, some schools of spiritual philosophy would even question the words true self in the belief that even the higher self is something that is unreal. And their arguments are not trivial. They're very deep arguments relative to authentic existence or real being and spirit, which would be agreed upon even by the people who have doubts about self, relative to that pure spirit, as in life spirit and divine spirit. The self is an idea. It is a divinely conceived idea, but it is an extremely important idea, because in its incompleteness and in its imperfection, because it is separate and it is not pure spirit, it has the capacity of forming ideas and being ideas that reflect the light and character of pure spirit back to itself, whereby the effect of waking self-consciousness is universalized in the highest attributes of spirit. Spirit is, and spirit spirits, spirit lives, but the self-consciousness, not in the negative sense of it, but in the positive words of self-consciousness with that perfect objectivity, is a result of reflection from the higher spiritual states on the higher self, or on that selfhood. It's very important. Boy, there's so much stuff to talk about. In any case, self, even though it is universal, is incomplete. Like, it's not like pure spirit. Now, you can prove this by logic, because the principles of logic indicate their ideas, all the principles of logic. And Eddie can tell you all about it. He had a mathematical course in which it is demonstrated indubitably in logical terms that any system that is logically self-consistent must be incomplete. And the other part of it, it's called the incompleteness theorem. It was by a Swiss mathematician. Oh, I'm forgetting his name now. Gödel. Not German, Swiss. I just got to tease a little bit. It's getting way too heavy and way too hard. The flip side of that coin is that even though every system of logic is incomplete and must be incomplete, is that there is truth beyond any system of logic. The man went insane at thinking this, and he considered himself a Neoplatonist, and he really did know Neoplatonism. But he couldn't reach that level of life spirit, that pure truth. Advice when speaking from said, I am the truth. So when we're talking here about human spirit, we're talking about something that's incomplete. But that incompleteness allows things to be brought to a finality. The incompleteness is found in a universal idea. And a universal idea is usually formulaic. So if you have the principle universal gravitation, you can make a mathematical statement of it. And within the consistency of that mathematical statement of that truth, there is an internal integrity. And so there is a limitation so that the principle applies throughout the universe, but it isn't all everything. And it is in that kind of limitation that there is a realization in an objectified way. The number three is always associated with that kind of objectification. Because three lines, and if you're dealing with straight lines, I don't want to go into all of that. I talked a little bit about that this morning. That three lines is the least number of lines in any number of dimensions, even n dimensions, to produce an object that has an inside and an outside. So when we're talking about the self as being an idea, that self has that same kind of internal limitation. But there's not really a mathematical type of formula for self. The formula or the way of expressing the integrity and basic nature of self is more like a story. It's more like a myth. And in the understanding of that myth, we understand the character of what it is to be a being within your being. And just like we get to know individuals as our friends within the faceless crowd. Only it's that level, concept on a much, much higher level and as it takes place in spirit. Now I'm way away from my notes now. I didn't intend to say all of these things, but it seemed a better way to say it than I had in the notes. It's very, very difficult. And so the saying of this is going to be very imperfect, and it gives you a chance to be graceful and not to judicial of me, or I'll go back to preaching again. Historically, the self has been an enormous problem in the union of self with the pure spirit. Different religions and different philosophies have taken different approaches to the problem. Some have thought of annihilating self. And you run into those kinds of philosophies. But if you annihilate self, you're eliminating the very function that it was created for. You know, God is not adventitious and just doesn't make creations like the idea of a self for the fun of it. Or as we said yesterday in the Luciferic way, for the hell of it, there is purposefulness for all of this. So annihilation is not a really good answer. Others have thought about transcending self. But with that, there is a degree of detachment. So there is not the spiritual intimacy of self with universal creation, like talking to Christ as a divine intelligence of everything. The Christianity seems to have dealt with the problem very well, the problem of self. The idea in Christianity is to give the self Christ. It's known, even the Jesus freaks. I hate seeing words like that. Even they understand the principle of giving self to Christ in a way that is real to their life. In the process of giving self to Christ, it does not annihilate self, and it doesn't remove one from the responsibility of self. It relates one to the selfness of all selves, which is what life spirit is. A self is generated out of the quality of selfness, which is why immediately if you have the experience of the life spirit, you're automatically an altruist. Automatically everyone is your friend. There is an image that I like to use, but it's one of those images that is dangerous. It's a classical image. If we think of life spirit as the ocean of like being. And suppose in that life that regenerates itself on itself, an eddy forms, like often forms in the ocean. That eddy is what we call self. It's an emptiness. It is a nothing. It's a necessary nothing that forms. It is a unique perspective within that ocean of a total being. The process of giving oneself to Christ is an action of transferring the attention from the empty, vacuous eddy to the ocean itself. So the self remains, but the perspective and the purpose for living is seen from the perspective of the all and not from doing one's own individual selfish thing. Very important thing. So, this is one of the great problems. Now, this carries the problem of self and waking objective consciousness to a much higher level. And it is another way that through self there is a reflection of spirit back to itself, in itself, in that way. With regard to cause and consequence, there are potential problems with self. And one of them you could call playing destiny. I've been guilty of it in the early days of my striving to grow spiritually. I tried to play destiny an awful lot. And I might still be guilty of it in ways that I don't even know. Almost everyone is tempted by it. If we are seeking salvation, or if we are seeking enlightenment, those are likely playing destiny, because we want those things for ourselves. The real way would be that we obtain salvation by helping others, that we stand down from thinking too much about ourselves for the sake of others. We forget about ourselves to help others. There is the Christian version of what is called the Bodhisattva ideal. That is, we should be willing to pass up salvation or enlightenment for the sake of someone else, that someone else could do it. And unless you can live that idea in a very genuine way without any taint of selfishness, you're not ready for salvation. You're going to have to slug around in all of these realms again. Playing destiny is when we initiate causes with the intent of receiving consequences that are favorable to ourselves. When I was young on the path, I said, I'm going to have a great life, my next life, because I'm going to do all these great things, and I'm going to get all the positive consequences from them. Now, the idea is philosophically fallacious, because if one knows what one is going to get in the first place, there's no reason to even do it. You're acting in vain, and all of your causes are superfluous. I hate to say it, but I'm going to say something very gross. It is like a spiritual masturbation, an expression of energy that is meaningless and purposeless merely for personal satisfaction. And so there is an emptiness. If one knows something already, one doesn't have to try to make sure that one gets it back. You know that already. If one does try to play destiny, one gets exactly what one needs. But when it comes back, it isn't what you expected. It, you know, It's second rate. It's empty. It's humiliating and it's disgraceful. When you get caught in selfishness, it's always disgraceful. And in a cosmic sense, if you say, I did that to get this measly reward, it's kind of a disgraceful thing. In self, because the self is not complete and it's not full to overflowing fullness, as pure spirit is, there is always a want or a need. That's always going to be the case. And when that want or need, which must be fulfilled from life spirit, from true life, from true purpose, from the truth itself, unless it is, the need is fulfilled that way, it isn't going to be satisfying. Now, human spirit, the home of the self or the spiritual ego, is reflectively projected into the desire world and the desire body. And that sense of spirit becomes the want or the need or the desire that causes us or motivates us to do things. The function of desire is to be motivating. And when we are recognized that something is wanting, either in ourselves or in someone else, that is what motivates us to take action. And even when we're propelled by desire, it is always on the basis of attraction. So this principle works in the desire world, which means it works in our everyday life without having to talk about it in a very high transcendental sense. Because if we give, and we give completely, and if we love, that inaugurates or initializes or puts into action the principle of attraction. But if we have a hitch, even the smallest hitch, where we're holding back or taking something to ourself, that produces a repulsion. And that furthers the emptiness. That furthers the unfulfilledness. And so it becomes, when we start playing destiny, and it becomes manifest on the desire plane in our everyday life, our life becomes more and more empty. When I was in college, I had a friend that for an entire summer tried to make love to a different woman every day and get drunk every night using both pot and alcohol. And toward the end of the summer, this was sort of a golden boy. He was an Apollo. He was very, very intelligent. He had all the scholarships he wanted. He was an athlete. He could box. And he was a musician. And he was very desirable to all of these women. And toward the end of the summer, I saw him on his knees in his living room with his head in his hand saying, where did it all go? Where I used to think about things like truth and beauty. And he recognized that no matter how hard he tried to satiate himself, it just ended up in hollowness and in emptiness. That's what happens when you repel everyone for you. But it's an example of the fact that cause and consequence is perfect. It's perfect feedback. It feeds back your emptiness as well as the fullness of the spirit that you put out. It's so perfect that it feeds back things that we were unconscious of when we initiated our causes. And that brings us to another very, very big topic. So part of the reason for the principle of cause and consequence is to bring us to awakening. A large part of our being is still unconscious. And some of the factors, when they return to us in a way that we don't even recognize them. And when we do, it is a step forward because we never knew we had these things in our unconscious being when we set out to do something. So perfect is the principle of cause and consequence that we have seen now that we cannot selfishly take advantage of it. Most of the spiritual principles are that way. Even the principle of attraction is that way. You would think, well, if I just give out love, I'm going to be able to sell all kinds of these things that I'm selling. But as soon as you start thinking selfishly, like I'm going to make all this money or something, you're not putting out all the love, and you can't violate the principle of attraction, and you can't violate cause and consequence. This is a law that has no loopholes, none whatsoever. It's a very beautiful thing. It's worth spending a whole week talking about, even though you might not think that way after sitting for five long nights. I suppose you've noticed by now that I'm excited, and something has happened that always happens when we aspire to spiritual things. We evoke all kinds of questions. And there are things that come up that we never knew existed before. Until we start an inquiry, we never will know that we're there. That's what's really good about the spiritual life, because it's always going to be exciting. Things of desire, as we can see, after a while become tiring. You can't tire out spirit, not at all. Now, most of the topics that we've talked about and that we have opened up are way too large, and we have only a few minutes left. In fact, we have minus 2 minutes left. These are meant to be only an hour long. So let's just take up one small thing. Oh, we did start 10 minutes late. Okay, we got 8 minutes to go. Let's take something that is very deep and very difficult and very treacherous to look at, but since we have only a small amount of time, let's look at it in a really shallow way. And just for the beginning, let's just familiarize ourselves with it. It's something that we just brought up a very few moments ago, and that is unconscious motivation. Simply stated, it says that we have motives of which we are not conscious. Now that's something curious. It means that there are things that we want or don't want that we don't even consciously know that we want or don't want. Now, everybody that has inquired into this subject, philosophers, mystics, psychologists have all recognized that there are various levels of unconsciousness and various varieties of unconsciousness. And almost everyone agrees that some of the unconscious parts of our being are benign and some are not. From the people who are willing to accept the idea of the unconscious, the theory of unconscious behavior, which many do not accept, the most common outlook is the outlook of the psychologists, the depth psychologists, most notably Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. Freud had only one level of unconsciousness, and for him it was very primal. It was a negative kind of thing, and it was of biological origin. For Carl Jung, he saw it on several levels, and he saw negative and positive aspects to it, which is much closer to what mystics in spiritual philosophy find. Neither Freud nor Jung thought that it was possible to delve into the unconscious directly, but only through symbols and associations and symptoms and things like that could you understand that black, dark unconsciousness. This is extremely different from mysticism. Mysticism believes that there is no part of the unconsciousness that we cannot enter into with full waking consciousness. That full waking consciousness may not be like the consciousness we have in the body right now, but there is no part that we can't enter into. Not only that, this is what we're supposed to be doing. This is the next frontier once we get beyond the ABCs of this material kind of existence. We explore the parts of our being that we are not yet awake to. In mysticism, we call that undesirable part of our unconscious, we call that the lower nature, or the false ego, or the pseudo-ego, or the second self. There are all different kinds of names for it. These psychologists have their own names, like Freud called it, for example, the id. Now, in Rosicrucian philosophy, this is going to be a very doctrinaire statement. Presumably, it is a statement of fact, but until we can see it all for ourselves, we have to take it tentatively. In Rosicrucian philosophy, we are taught that the false ego was built into the higher part of our desire nature after the fall of humanity in Lemuria. Because by taking the creative power into our own hands, we were declaring ourselves as being gods. And the other divine beings that used to lead us willy-nilly through every experience that we had to step back. They had to respect our divinity. But we didn't have an instinct then, because that's really what instinct is a divine guidance for various types of beings, animals, plants, things like that. And without that divine guidance, we had to have somebody, something to look out for number one. And so this reflective pseudo-self was put into the beings that were capable of having a divided desire nature. But the best laid plans of mice and men oft go awry. And what happened is that the Lucifer spirits and other beings that helped us into the fall in the first place got a hold of us and brought to that pseudo-self the notion that in waking consciousness we're not aware of things. When we're focused in the material world, we're not aware of things that are working in the background inside of us. And it taught that lower nature to set up shop for itself. It usurped the kingdom of the body for its own ends. And not only that, it taught it to revel in its own nature. That is desire. And the most extreme kinds of desire that produced the strongest passions that we were capable of, sex and violence. And so over the thousands and thousands of years since that time, to when we have become as we are now, the lower nature has been building in more and more ways of reproducing the first and second sins. The sins of Adam and the sins of Cain. The sins of sex and the sins of violence. And from the overblow of those experiences, the Lucifers and other beings can get secondhand experience and further their evolution in a way they couldn't otherwise. And this is what has brought us to the state that we are in. And this is what that selfish lower nature does. the purpose of the pseudo-ego was then preservation, self-preservation, to move forward. Now, our evolutionary task at this point, if we want to reunite our total consciousness, which is divided between the lower nature and the higher nature, sometimes we can think very devilish thoughts and have very devilish desires, and sometimes there are things that we experience and that we think in ourselves that are godlike. So if we want a union of our consciousness, which now straddles the higher and lower nature, the lower nature must be tamed. And it must come under the control of the higher nature. And instead of being an internal argument of what the two parts of our being want, it should be like a dialogue as that we hear in the lives of saints, like in The Imitation of Christ by Thomas a Kempis, where the individual, the self, is talking to Christ, and the lower nature, which is made for asking questions, asks questions, and the higher nature provides answers that are more than satisfying. And so this is what we have to do. We have to recognize where we are coming from in ourself, and if it is not from our higher nature, how we can take that which is being initiated from a lower part of our being and bring it in conformance with the divine intent of the higher part of our being. And in this activity, since both the self and the lower self are under the principle of the third attribute, and that principle is the principle of the law, that the law of cause and consequence is one of our very best tools for accomplishing this. Because when we see the fruits of what we have done, like, for example, just take a ride out in the country, look at the woods, and then look at the ugly human buildings, or look at the way the rivers flow, and then look at our highways. We are not built into the macrocosm. Our fruits are ugly. Not all of them. We have, you know, she makes beautiful pictures. So from cause and consequence, we can see and recognize what is the result of the lower part of our being as manifested in fruits and deeds that turn out to be ugly, that turn out to be harmful. So in following from cause, from consequence, back to cause, as we do in retrospection, it takes us back to the cause, and it takes us back to the causal agency within our own being, and we can see for ourselves what was within us. So this is why, as spiritual students, the principle of retrospection, working to bring together with the principle of cause and consequence, brings to us very definite knowledge about our own being, very definite knowledge that we can do something about. And that's the whole purpose for tonight's talk, was to get to that. And I'm going to end with a poem. It's one of my favorite poems. It's my favorite Shakespeare sonnet, one of my favorite all-time poems. And it states this that we have been talking about for the last few minutes perfectly and beautifully. It's sonnet number 119. What potions have I drunk of siren tears, distilled from limbics foul as hell within, applying fears to hopes and hopes to fears, still losing when I saw myself to win. What wretched errors hath my heart committed, whilst it hath thought itself so blessed never? How have mine eyes out of their spheres been fitted in the distraction of this madding fever? O benefit of ill, now I find true that better is by evil still made better, and ruined love, when it is built anew, grows fairer than at first, more strong, far greater. So I return, rebuked to my content, and gain by ills thrice more than I have spent. All right, we'll close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Any questions that can be answered in 30,000 or less words?
I do have a question.
Yeah. It has to go through the higher self, which is divine. And that's exactly what we're talking about. It is a remembrance of self. Because when we do something wrong, we often slap ourselves in the head and say, oh, I forgot myself. And when we remember ourself in a true nature, then we intuitively know the truth of what the right thing is to do. In fact, we have two ways of doing that. We can remember ourselves as God, divine being, or we can remember the level of divinity still higher yet when Christ says, this do in remembrance of me.
My understanding that we are to reunite with God. The question is that supposed to be one in thought or one in actual being?
It is, we bring the divine all the way into the total of our existence. It is called the spiritualization of matter. So that we have, in effect, they aren't exactly like this, that we have, in effect, bodies that are like this, that are spiritualized bodies. But that's only the beginning, because once spiritualized, it becomes generalized, and our bodies become something much different than what they are now. But it would, in direct answer to your question, we bring it right into all of this. It isn't just in thought. If it were just in thought, then we wouldn't need to have this all in the first place. Because it is through these vehicles that we spiritualize the world. This isn't just for ourselves alone. There are other beings, the beings that are within the stuff of matter, that are being raised up also. And it is through our bodies, which are microcosms of the macrocosm. You know, this is a dense physical body made of the same dense physical matter, and that becomes a vehicle for matter to be exalted in a different way.
Which brings me to the next question. Because in some place in the Bible, it is stated by Christ, I think he asked the question, or he states it as a rhetorical question, do ye not know that ye are as God?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what we said in the very first part.
Right. Okay. If that is stated, that's God's plural.
Yes.
All right. So
there's a difference between God and spirit. Right. A God is a focus of spirit. This is why I, if you look at every talk that I've given for at least 20 years, I differentiate between spirit and God. Especially universal spirit and pure spirit, versus the level of spirit or godhood or individuation into a special or unique focus is accomplished.
So what we're saying, or what I'm understanding here, then, is that the one, the life force, is the one, and it is the spirit, and that is what we are trying to commune with and trying to become one with.
Yes.
But in the process, even after having gone through this material and it exists no more, you could be gods and still not really part of, you'd be much closer, but you would not be as part of the life force itself. You would be constantly creating and moving upward and closer and closer and closer.
No, you would lose a lot of the specific individual qualities in order to reach those higher levels, but the essence of it gets superimposed on them. For we're at a subject now that is so recondite and that is so deeply complex that I don't think I want to go any further into that, because it takes years of thinking to differentiate between the different states of spirit and what those relationships of those different states of spirit are to the manifestation as a focus of spirit as an individual divine being. That's that there are transmutations that occur on those transcendental levels that you have to have an understanding of that is very hard to reach with human understanding. The hillbillies, for example, don't even start talking about transmutation or transformation until they're talking on those levels. They don't begin to talk about transformation except on the level of life spirit, which is beyond the individual. But I don't want to go into talking about the hillbillies. That's their, you know.
What are the hillbillies?
The hillbillies is a joking reference to the Tibetan Buddhists. It's not disrespectful, because I have great respect for what they do in those transformations of consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, they do a lot of serious spiritual work.
Yes. Ariel?
I have two things, and I must admit, I did fall asleep.
Hooray! Yes! That's an accomplishment. Somebody as lively as you, I thought I could never put to sleep.
Well, I just thought it was, you know, it was something else, but I want to add to what Jerry said. I suddenly realized, you know, like when I'm dreaming and I'm watching everything in the dream, or even when I'm awake now and I'm talking and I'm aware that I'm talking, that is God.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. That which is watching in the dream, yes.
I mean, that's it, and it's
It's
within me, but it's not me. It's
yes.
not this,
yes.
but
yes.
that is it.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I have is...
That sounds like a very statement.
Well, that was just me proving that, you know...
Yeah, no, I
had a realization. The other thing, I had this question, it's been bothering me a long time, it seems to fit in here, is, you know, we go around and we think we're hot shit and we're creating all this crap and we're in the material world and oh, we're so spiritual and we're material and oh, and I'm beaming out love to all of you and whatever.
Yes.
What do you do? How do you live in the world when you get to that place where you actually see through the veneer of all that, that illusion, that veil, you know, and you go, oh my God, I can't participate in this anymore. This is insane. I don't want to be part of this, like greed, corruption, and this is all judgment coming from me
saying that.
But what do you do when you reach that point where you see
you
all that?
Very quiet.
I was thinking. Oh no!
I mean that very seriously.
Yeah.
You become quiet and you find ways to participate
mm-hmm.
because those things are very ephemeral. And even with the most profane of the profane, it's still ephemeral. And if you wait it out, you find times that you can say appropriate things that are helpful. In the meantime, you try to understand what the higher things are that they're mismanifesting, and that helps them to learn from their own life, even though their life is filled with egregious mistakes.
So he just keeps showing up and basically being a hard example.
You find subtler ways to help. The spiritual worlds are more subtle. There are, you know, there are all kinds of fireworks, but the fireworks aren't what is really the main reality. It's the subtlety that it takes to get there. And that applies to what Jerry was talking about before with all that transcendence. There is a subtlety. There are subtleties in transcendental. I read a lot of Platonism, and they talk in an abstract philosophical way about all of those things. You can find it all over. It's harder to decode if you read something like Vedantin metaphysics, but those are things where people have definite knowledge of those higher states, but to some extent they are, if you participate in that too early, they are distracting from fulfilling one's duties right here. And if you learn to bring the spirit here rather than trying to float out of the spirit, you are more likely to be a creative participant in what the spirit is trying to accomplish here.
That's why it sort of becomes inside out then, where the sort of more spiritual insight you begin to attain for yourself, the greater need there is to be grounded.
Yes.
Because then you really need to live in the world.
Fulfill the purpose of the evolutionary creation, yes.
Yeah, okay. So I'm in the right place, I guess.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.